This is the Workplace Podcast with your host, William Corliss, brought to you in association with Yellowwood, providers of executive coaching, corporate training and facilitation, your external learning and development partner. Each week, we focus on a different aspect of the workplace. We hear from guest speakers who are subject matter experts and are incredibly talented at what they do. These experts will give you a different perspective and insight to work life, with the aim of empowering you to take a different path to success in all aspects of work life. These perspectives will include career and personal success, leadership, high-performance teams, and creating a better work-life culture in your organization. Yellowwood, take a different path to success with your career, team, and organization.
Welcome to the Workplace Podcast. Joining us today is Melissa Clark. Melissa is an Associate Professor of Industrial Organization Psychology at the University of Georgia and Director of the Healthy Work Lab. She's also the author of Never Not Working, Why the Always-On Culture is Bad for Business and How to Fix It, which is our topic today. Melissa, welcome to the Workplace Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So it's a pleasure to have you here and a huge congratulations on this book. So as someone that was reading this book who has struggled with this topic of overwork and workaholism, I was reading this with trying to understand and gain insights to what led me to overwork and being a workaholic. And it reminded me of my own journey where I was working with someone who was helping me out. And it was when I was starting my own business, and the person was really taken back by how my workload was. I was my ability to withstand my workload and my energy to do that. And when I regaled my week, and the reason I say regaled, because it was like a badge of honor, look what I did. And I was working, you know, 14, 15 hour days. And then she made this wonderful insight. You're not a human doing, you're a human being, which I thought was really, really.
I love that.
Yeah.
So profound.
It was. And that's why I found your book so interesting. So I think this book, for anybody that's struggling with workload at the moment or workaholism, it really creates that self-awareness. And I have to really admire your book here, because it will steer people towards there's light at the end of the tunnel there. So I highly recommend this book, Melissa, to our listeners.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the high compliments. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a great read. And you made this your life's work. So what brought you through this topic? Is it a bit like you had to understand yourself and your own relationship, or how did it come about?
Yeah, it's exactly that, really. I call it me search, right? Trying to understand why I approach work in this way. It sounds like a very similar way to the way that you work. And, you know, this goes all the way back to when I was a kid, thinking about what, you know, I got involved with when I was in school, and, you know, especially in high school, I remember just being involved in so many different after school activities and clubs, and I played sports, and I had at least one job, if not two. And it really didn't stop from there, you know, into college and then into the workforce. And I was always just going, always striving to be better and, you know, kind of wearing that long hours as the badge of honor. And, you know, when I got into graduate school, I came across an article where they talked about this thing called workaholism. And I was like, what is this? It just sounds like a catchy term. But then I really dove into the science behind it, and I realized, wow, this is exactly what I am. Like, I am a workaholic. Oh my gosh. And so here's the different components of it. And I just really dove into the research and have honestly been studying it since I was in graduate school. So really my whole career has been spent really understanding, you know, why people tend to engage in work in this way, and what are the outcomes of it. And in writing this book, you know, just really took a deep dive with lots of conversations with individuals that struggle with workaholism. So yeah, it was really a journey for me.
And you mention in your book that we're living really in an age of overwork. So I'm thinking about AI, it's a tool to be more productive. And then you have all these terms like work addiction and work martyr and toxic productivity and hustle culture. And to really understand it, then, is workaholism and the approach to it, is it more than just self-care, or is there something else?
Is it more than just self-care? Is that what you said?
Yeah, yeah.
When I think of workaholism, a lot of people kind of conflate this with just long hours working. And that's kind of how we've talked about it so far. But it's more than just the number of hours you put into your work. It also involves kind of a compulsion to work that really a lot of these stem from within us. And so there's a motivational component where we feel driven to work all the time. Like, we always feel like we ought to be doing something. We ought to be working on XYZ. Scholars, we call it introjected motivation is like the technical term, but really it's that pit in your stomach feeling like, oh, I've got to go, go, go all the time. Because I should, this is just what I should do. And with that comes compulsive thoughts. So always thinking about work and not being able to focus, when you're out of work, not being able to focus on things that you're doing, like hanging out with your friends or your family. Maybe it's keeping you up at night, thinking about work, what happened that day or what will happen tomorrow. And this also triggers negative emotions that when we're not working, we feel anxious or guilty, sometimes even frustrated. And so it's all of those things. It's not just the long hours. It's basically how work consumes us.
And that's where I like this book, is it's really understanding what's driving our behavior. So even for me, I was thinking about like a fear of being lazy or guilty about resting. And especially when you talk about that anxious is, I feel like I should be doing something or not doing enough. Never is enough. Isn't that really the mind of a workaholic?
Yeah, it's basically almost like an inability to be idle. You might struggle with some of the same things that I do. You know, I struggle with just doing nothing, just sitting down and relaxing, or, watching a TV show without simultaneously picking up my laptop to answer some emails. That's something I struggle with all the time, kind of mixing work into these supposed to be fun activities. And just sitting and doing nothing and just being idle is extremely difficult for individuals that have workaholic tendencies. Absolutely.
You've so many, different aspects to the book, and we'll go to that in a minute. The stats on this are frightening. So half of the US workers classify themselves as workaholics. And for millennials, the figure is 66. So this is growing in terms of a severe issue around the world.
And it's really hard to pinpoint even those numbers too. Those might be underestimating, because a lot of people don't identify as a workaholic. But then when you dig a little deeper and you ask them about, their job and, how often they're actually working, and when they're not at work, what are they kind of randomly checking work emails, and do they have a hard time taking vacations, all of those things. When you dig a little deeper, people oftentimes will say, well, I do this, but I'm not a workaholic. One common thing is people to say, well, I'm not a workaholic because I love my work. Yes, I do all these things, and work is very much like the most prominent part of my life, but I enjoy it, so I'm not a workaholic. And that's a very common myth. You can be someone who loves your work. We call it work engagement. And there's a ton of research showing that has positive outcomes for individuals, for organizations. However, that doesn't exist. It's not like two ends of the same continuum. You can be an engaged worker, but you can also have these workaholic tendencies. And what we see is that you can experience some of the positive outcomes of being an engaged worker. But if you also can't put work down ever, and you can't disengage from work, you also experience the negative outcomes that come with workaholism. And this is health outcomes, relationship outcomes, and eventual burnout, So it's not an either or, and oftentimes it's both. And I'm also someone who loves my job, but that's part of the problem, because of my love for my job, it is difficult to turn it off. And at the same time, when I'm feeling excited about things, I also feel, you know, very unsettled when I'm not working, even when I'm supposed to be doing something fun.
That's where some people might be listening in. Sometimes I put on the devil's advocate here. So some people might say, well, you know, grow up, that's just work, get on with it, you know. And, you know, sometimes I think, you know, that's the culture, isn't it? So it's like a lot of people kind of buy into the culture. And that's why I mentioned work culture and that hustle and the work martyr and toxic productivity and all these terms there. And because we're in the culture, then we can't see it. Isn't that right? Because everybody else around us is doing it.
Yeah. One woman I interviewed called it, you know, this is like water to a fish. We just don't even recognize it because it surrounds us. It's just part of everything. It's from a young age, we're taught, you know, you work hard enough, you're going to be successful and achieve everything you ever dreamed of. And, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and work harder if things aren't going right. And, you know, we're taught that from a very young age. We have this idealized vision of what the ideal worker should be. And that's someone who prioritizes work above everything else. And if we all have this shared kind of prototype of what we should be doing, it's no wonder that that is kind of how CEOs form their organizations and, you know, hire people that have the same philosophy as them and then tends to reinforce with new people that come in the organization. And oftentimes it's celebrated, right? So there are companies that have made t-shirts like, thank God it's Monday, or, you know, very blatantly, like, this is what you should love. And, you know, so it is something that, yes, it is. Workaholism is something that people can vary on, and there are some individual differences in workaholic tendencies, but our society and our work culture in our organizations and even our relationships with our supervisors can exacerbate this kind of attachment and obsession with work, and kind of making us feel guilty from society almost too. Like, why am I not working hard enough? I need to be doing this. So it's like partially internalized societal pressure. So that's very interesting to think about. It's like, maybe it's not all within us. Maybe it's sort of within us, but we're kind of taught this too. So yeah, it is a mix of the person and the situation.
I find it insane that somebody would go around in a t-shirt saying, thank God it's Monday.
Right.
That aside, you mentioned the ideal worker then. So the ideal worker then, that myth then, is overwork then, if I'm a leader, kind of going, well, why should I care? Sure, that's good for business, isn't it?
That's a common myth too. Yeah, absolutely. It's very common for me to hear things just like that. And well, I mean, but this leads to greater productivity, so why shouldn't we be embracing this and actively kind of pushing employees to work harder? And indeed, there are a lot of organizations that do this and firmly believe that that is the route to success. But if you look at the research, not just with workaholism, but with long work hours, it's overwhelmingly negative. And so it's not just that it's detrimental to people's health, which it is, for various reasons. I mean, the main one is we can't just be going all the time without taking breaks and building back the resources that we spent at work that day. And, you know, people liken it to this idea of fight or flight. So that's a healthy response to a threat in our environment. When our cortisol levels go up and our heart starts racing, and we get this like adrenaline rush, which prepares us to, you know, handle the threat in our environment. But the big issue is that when we have this environment where we're constantly told you need to work harder and this is so important, you need to devote all your time to it, it's almost like we live in constant crisis mode. And then so we never go back to equilibrium, and it wears us down, just like, you know, going on a 2,000-mile road trip wears your car down. You know, you need that rest and you need that recovery. And so that's one of the big reasons that we see links with health issues, high blood pressure, heart attacks, sleep issues, autoimmune disorders, inflammations, all of these different things, you know, and a big part of it is just this lack of being able to get back to baseline, to reset our bodies, to be able to handle the next stressor.
And then in the book, you mentioned that, well, are workaholics more productive? And then you mentioned Pankaval's model. Hopefully I pronounced that correctly. Yes. And I got to quote this. Someone who works 70 hours is no more productive than someone who puts in 55 hours. That's an amazing stat.
It really is. I know, it blew my mind. His book is called Diminishing Returns, and it's really wonderful. He's an economist. And so he's run these models that basically, it shows that after 55 hours, our productivity starts to decrease at a very constant pace. And so, and it's basically, he talks about effective hours working versus actual hours working. And the easiest way that I can think of to explain it is you think about your energy levels at the beginning of a work day. That's when I write the best and when I feel like the sharpest, you know, and at the end of the work day, 5 o'clock at night, if I went to try to do something that took a lot of thought and effort, I'm just not as sharp at that point. I'm tired. It's been, you know, a full day. And so broaden that to kind of the work week. It's basically like, we might spend those hours, those actual hours working, but our productive hours is becoming smaller and smaller the longer we're working without breaks and rest. And so that's why we have this law of diminishing returns. And, you know, at a certain point, it's basically like you're just wasting hours. You're just filling the space with work when you really would be much more productive if you stop working, go home, detach from work, you know, enjoy time with your family, and then come back to work well rested, and then you can be even more productive. And that's where your productive hours are very much aligned with your actual hours.
So if I was trying to make sense of this, then, and I think you mentioned it at the start of the podcast, what are the four main components then of workaholism?
Yes. So the behavioral part is the long work hours, you know, doing things like taking work with you on vacations and integrate work into all these aspects of your life. Then there's the motivational component, this feeling like you should be working, this compulsion. Then there's the cognitive component. So you're thinking about work all the time. It's really hard for you to do what we call psychological detachment from work. So that's basically like shutting your mind off, shutting work off in your mind. And so, you know, constantly thinking about work and being distracted by work, that kind of thing. And the fourth dimension is the emotions. And this is really about emotions when you're not working. That's partly what's driving you to work, when you feel guilty or just really unsettled or anxious or uneasy, and, you know, frustrated perhaps. You know, say you're at home and it's the end of your work day, but you know you have something important to do, or you think it's important, and so you're trying to get it done, but your kids are coming in, you know, mommy, daddy, look at this. And you're like, just a minute. And you feel that frustration, like that is the emotional component right there. And I know I'm guilty of that too, for sure.
And that's that inner compulsion, I have to do this. And another compulsion, now that I think about it, is that need to be constantly connected or constantly responsive. So for example, I'm in a different time zone to you. And if we're working on a team, it might be your afternoon, but it's my evening then. And then I see an email pop up, answer that, and now I'm not switching off. And then my kids are kind of going, dad, dad, dad. You know, well, no, I don't do this, but I'm just, you know, if we were, it'd be that connection.
Yeah.
Responsiveness that's really, really impacting people at the moment, especially since the pandemic. It's gone insane, I believe.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I, you know, my belief is that COVID has made some things worse, and specific to technology and our communication patterns. And Microsoft had some really fascinating research during COVID where they tracked people's use of their platforms. And what they found was that there were multiple peaks of productivity, you know, right at the beginning of the day, and then sort of in the afternoon, there was another peak as people were wrapping up and getting ready to leave. But during the pandemic, there was a portion of people who had a third peak of productivity, and that was in the evening. And as someone who has kids, I can imagine, probably because I've done it many times myself, you put the kids to bed, and then you're like, okay, I'm going to catch up on these few work emails, whatnot. And so they found that third peak of productivity in the evening. So this is not during work hours. And it became normalized. And for a period of time, it was of necessity because a lot of people had the time during the day with kids home and schooling from home. And that took time out of the workday. So almost like having to make it up, understandable, right? But then as we come out of the pandemic, we almost got used to being able to communicate with our colleagues and our employees much more frequently and much less predictably. And so maybe we got used to having those team conversations in the evening. And you're like, well, this is actually, you think, great, because, oh, we can tackle this thing and not have to wait till the morning. But the problem is then nobody's disengaging and everyone's feeling like, oh, I need to be checking my email now because this is when things happen. And so we picked up some really bad habits, I believe.
I'm going to quote directly from the book. So it's on page 150 of Never Not Working. And what you have here is the cycle of responsiveness, how genuine pressure to be on gets amplified through our own actions. So pressure to be on, to succeed, I have to be responsive. The adapt and adjust to make it possible to be on, so I make sure I'm always accessible, available more, and others start making requests so others know they can count on me to be being accessible. Okay. And this is from the book, Sleeping with Your Smartphone. Self-imposed pressure to respond. So many requests are urgent and I'm available and want to be perceived that way, so I respond. Besides, I like to keep up with my work. And then finally, that culture of responsiveness. Everyone here is tethered to their smartphone 24/7. So it's, it's just pervasive, isn't it?
It is. And that is a great example of how it's not just an individual issue, right? This is something that is more about the way we work and the culture of work and how technology has, you know, in many ways it's been great, right? But in other ways it has been detrimental. And one of the big ways it's been detrimental is tethering us to work and making us feel this pressure, you know, as you talked about that cycle. It's like as people learn your work patterns, and if you start signaling to them that you are checking your email at these times in the evening or on the weekend, then they know to reach out to you, and then you feel that pressure to respond to them. And it's just like this, it's just this really negative cycle that emerges. And it's hard to break because it's not just you, it's everyone in your work team.
I'm going to share, I suppose, my maybe addiction to busyness, or, you know, not being able to switch off. And when I realized what it was, I was able to take control of it. And what I had was that constant work rumination then when I was trying to switch off, and I struggled to sleep, I put on weight, you know, I was anxious, all these different things. And what I noticed there was when I worked deeper on this, it was a deep insecurity of wanting to have that sense of belonging. You know, I was the go-to guy, you know, I was the person that always wanted to be helpful. And these are the emotional and thoughts and these inner narratives that, what, you know, as Marshall Goldsmith says, what got you here won't get you there, you know. And I really, really connected with this book in that way because it helped me reaffirmed, go, oh yeah, well, that's why I don't respond to emails in the evening, because I go into this pattern for myself. And everybody has their own pattern, don't they, Melissa?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not a one size fits all, for sure. And, you know, I think that is an issue that a lot of people struggle with, is that this working hard all the time and being the go-to person almost becomes part of their identity. And then they forget there are other really great things about their identity that people like them for. And they kind of hone in on, well, this is why people like me as a colleague, because I can handle things immediately. And it kind of reinforces this feeling like you have to be very responsive and always connected to work. And yeah, that makes it very difficult to disconnect. And I heard some pretty heartbreaking stories of people that that I met through the organization Workaholics Anonymous. I interviewed many individuals that were members. And so at that point, they were going through their recovery and kind of identifying, looking backwards in their life at these moments. And I remember talking with a man by the name of Gabe, who, you know, just realized when his health issues caused it so he couldn't work anymore, he almost felt like, you know, why, what am I even doing? What is the purpose of being here if I can't work? Like, what else is there? And it wasn't just him. It was many individuals that, you know, usually it was always some sort of health reason that kind of forced their hand, and they had to take a break from work. And really it hit them, this almost like identity crisis. And it is like kind of what you're talking about. Like, they equated being a good worker as like the most important thing. And this is why people want to work with me. And this is why people look up to me. And, you know, again, I think it's important to recognize that. And it sounds like you really have had that self-reflection, but oftentimes it's very difficult to tease apart that belief that, you know, this is my whole identity, versus, you know, there are many other reasons that I'm a good colleague, that I'm a good person. So yeah, it's very complicated.
And when I first came across the topic of workaholism, I was studying in the School of Economics, and I came across research done by Gene Twenge. And when I read that paper, how that was workaholics were over-identify with work. And, you know, it's part of that self-esteem that, well, who am I if I don't do this job, or if I'm not that person? And something that reinforces that, and the trap that I feel I slipped into was, I figured out quite quickly, sitting down at coffee or at lunch with my colleagues in certain organizations, that, well, people were demonized by, you know, not doing this. And the people who were celebrated were the people who, you know, were responsive. And they're great. They got back to me last night at 8 o'clock. And it's carried through the stories, that it's just off the cuff stories, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah. I talk about that. And, you know, there's lots of signals that organizations can give, even, you know, not even realizing it, that indicate what is valued in that organization. And there is a book that, well, I'm blanking on the name of it right now, but they talked about in Best Buy, some consultants came in and they were trying to change the overwork culture, and employees they would call it sludge. Little comments here and there that indicated that they were dissatisfied with someone because they weren't doing what the status quo was. And in that organization, it was people that would take time off to handle a family obligation, or people that left work early or came in a little later. And it was like, oh, here they go again, taking their afternoon coffee hour. You know, that is sludge, they call it. And I love that concept of, you know, even when you're trying to change the culture, you can get these like little nuggets that people don't even realize sometimes that they're reinforcing that overwork culture. And like you said, sometimes it's explicitly rewarded. You know, so-and-so got this bonus or got this promotion. Why? Well, because, you know, they regularly sacrifice their weekends for work. And isn't that a great thing? And, you know, so they should be a manager now. And then it just kind of perpetuates that belief and really exacerbates the problem.
I think this is a real eye-opener, especially for leaders. And on page 112, you have a table where the examples of specific signals of workaholic culture within an organization, and you outline the organization artifacts and the signs of overwork and workaholic culture. So we've covered a few of them so far. So you have the physical artifacts, which is the workaholic jargon, which is, thank God it's Monday, socialization. So newcomers should be first in and last out, all that type of stuff. You have stories and legends, what we just covered. You know, norms like working through lunch, rituals, there is like mandatory company meetings during off work times, rewards, who gets promoted, why, you just said, and then role models, who do leaders role model workaholic behaviors. And I think that is such a reality check for people that especially leaders that might have blind spot to this.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's a really good activity to sit down and think about each one of these things in your organization and see if there are some things that maybe people are doing, or the, you know, patterns in the organization that can be changed. You know, Adam Grant once said the most direct way to figure out what's valued in a culture isn't to listen to what people say is important. It's to pay attention to some of these things, like who gets rewarded, who gets promoted. And so regardless of what the organization claims, and regardless of the number of employee wellness programs that they might offer, or flexibility arrangements, or even unlimited vacation days, all of those things, you really need to dig a little deeper and see, are people actually using these things? And if people are, what are people saying about those individuals? Is there some sludge there that basically reinforces, regardless of what you have, this is what's done? And so that's a common issue. You know, I could talk about this forever, but yeah, I'm really just looking at all of these different artifacts can really give you a lot of clues into what you're reinforcing with your employees.
And that's the signals from an organization point of view. And then if it's okay, I'm going to go through some of the questions here in one of the assessments. Then, am I a workaholic? And I might go through three or four of them, if that's okay. So this is reprinted from the Workaholics Anonymous book of recovery. So are you afraid that if you do not work hard all the time, you will lose your job or be a failure? Like, I was just kind of going, everybody would answer yes to that. Do you try to multitask to get more done? Do you get irritated when people ask you to stop doing what you're doing in order to do something else? You think about work or other tasks while you're driving, conversing, falling asleep or sleeping. Do you feel agitated when you're idle? You know, the list goes on. There's 20 questions altogether. Do you feel like you're a slave to your emails?
I know. Going through that assessment, I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. To relate to so many of these. Yeah.
Yeah. It's such an eye-opener. So with that in mind, right, what are some helpful tips that we can have? And you mentioned Adam Grant there, who I'm a fan of, and I'm sure you are too by reading the book. And even Adam Grant, you requested his presence on a podcast in your research for the book, and he was able to say no. So that's one tip. What are the other tips that could be
say no? Yeah.
Yeah. Can be helpful to people to combat workaholism.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that I think can be useful. And again, it's not a one size fits all. So some of these you might be like, that won't work for me. So that's why I kind of give just a wide variety of examples. So one thing that you might want to do is think about your to-do list. I know I always have the written to-do list every day. I kind of make a new one. And a common issue is feeling like you have to get through everything on your list, and the workday cannot be completed until you do that. The problem is our work to-do lists are never ending. There is always something else that can be added. And so to instead kind of reinvent this to-do list as a way of mapping and prioritizing. So some suggestions that people have offered is to organize your task based on how urgent they are and how important they are. And you mentioned Adam Grant, and that's kind of something that he does as well. You know, he focuses on the projects that are most meaningful and important to him, and then puts other things below that. And I really like that idea of just thinking about it as a way to prioritize and focus your attention. And then the things that aren't as urgent or aren't as important, are there some things you can move to another day or another week, or things you can get rid of completely by saying no, or by delegating to other people? You know, workaholics tend to be really poor delegators and thinking that they're the only one that can do this thing right. And so they have to be the one to do it. But that's part of the issue. You know, good leaders empower their followers. And so thinking about it that way, actually delegating is good for them, good for their development. And we're not experts in everything. So why don't we just focus on things that we do best and try to find others that do these other things better? And then you're kind of elevating the whole team. And, you know, I think one of the other things that I find useful, you know, really engaging in rest and recovery activities are so important. And oftentimes people that have these workaholic tendencies have a very difficult time with some of them. For example, meditation or mindfulness. I think because of that urge to always kind of be doing something, that idleness can be pretty daunting. Although I will say a lot of the individuals that I talked to through Workaholics Anonymous eventually realized how helpful that was. But if you're not quite there yet, one thing that I have found helpful is to engage in what's called a mastery experience. So this is after work, right? So you're trying to disengage. Maybe you can't shut off these workaholic thoughts. So find something that captures your attention, that you find enjoyable, that's not work-related, but is challenging enough that it kind of forces you to think about something else and focus on something else. So this could be anything, really. My student does woodworking and he really is passionate about that. You could learn a new language. You could learn how to play an instrument. There's a variety of things that when you're doing that thing, you realize, you know, after you've been engaging it for an hour or so, wow, you know, I actually haven't been thinking about work. That's what you need, so that you're still doing something, but it's still recovery. And it's been shown to be particularly helpful for workaholics who have a hard time doing nothing. So I find that one particularly helpful for me personally.
And for me, I find actually walking, I'm in the woods, so I'm quite near to mountains and a wooded area here. And I absolutely love that. And it allows me to really to switch off. So I think it's a great point you made, was to find something that works for you and that mastery piece. And again, a really helpful point you make is not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yeah, I mean, because that can really make the problem so much worse. And it's hard to realize that it's not going to be perfect. But I think it's really important to think about things as like, it's good enough. Does it really need to be this, you know, the report, the office report that is the best of the whole year? What is that going to get you? You know, maybe a pat on the back. You know, you don't need your spreadsheets to be absolutely 100% perfect, or, you know, the pitch to the client. You can get it so it's pretty darn good, but do you really need to stay up all night practicing it? And actually, maybe it'd be better if you just got a good night's sleep, so you could be sharp the next morning and be able to answer questions at the end of the presentation. So it could be really difficult to just recognize that perfect is the enemy of done, for sure.
I've got to ask you this. So Parkinson's Law, there's a couple of things that you introduced. So what's Parkinson's Law? Introduce our listeners to that.
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating concept that a historian wrote about. His name is Northcote Parkinson, and he talks about how we fill time. And so he talks about work specifically, and I'm quoting him. He said, "Work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion." And so it really struck me, because thinking back to different work assignments, things that I do for my job day in and day out, maybe I have a paper that's due on a certain date. Regardless if the paper is due a week from then or a month from then, I find a way to make it so I get it done. But for some reason, the longer out the deadline, the more things I find to do related to that. And I don't know if those additional things made it any better. And so when I also think about like the workday, for example, our 8-hour workday or 9-hour, 10 hours, whatever it is, it's almost like this law applies to how we think about work, that our workday, we find tasks that fill the time because we're supposed to work 8 hours. But why are we doing that? Do we actually need that many hours to be productive? And I would argue we absolutely do not. Technology, AI, all these things continue to make our tasks quicker and easier. We send an email now instead of writing a handwritten letter like they used to back in the day, So think about all the things that have saved us time, but yet we still keep the work day the same. Why aren't we shortening that? Because we have found ways to be more efficient. Instead, all we do is fill that work time with additional things. And so, yeah, I really loved that concept of thinking about, how we just tend to expand our work because it's supposed to be done in this amount of time. I'm a big fan of things like the 4-day work week, for example. I really do think we need to reconsider how many hours we actually need to be working. And this goes back to our conversation about actual hours versus productive hours.
I think that's a podcast on its own, a 4-day working week, and especially...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Especially what you've written about. And then you introduce that to that notion. And speaking of time, it just popped into my head, time discounting. So time discounting, then I think it's really important in how people perceive how much time that they have available to them, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We feel like the time we spend in the short term is almost like more valuable than the time in the long term. We tend to make decisions based on those short-term rewards and gains, but we don't think about how that might affect us down the road. For example, if you keep on telling yourself, well, but I'm working 80 hours a week because I, just started at this company, or I just started this business. And that may be true, but kind of recognize there might be ebbs and flows in how often or how much time you need to spend to your work. And I understand that. But if this is something you're always telling yourself, that I always need to be working this long so I can get the money now, or so I can get that promotion now, well, what is that costing you in the long term? Think about like your future self. Is this affecting your relationships? Are you spending these 80 hours, but really not spending any time with your partner or your kids? How might that affect you down the road 10 years from now? Do you want to have a relationship with your kids? Well, build that time in now while they're in the house so that later when they leave, you have a good relationship. And I try to really reflect on that with myself, thinking about what are my big values. What are the parts of my identity besides work? And am I kind of living true to all of those different identities, not just work?
And I think something that helped me reset a lot of my habits, and you mentioned this in the book, and I came across this a couple of years ago, was the nurse who talked about the regrets of the dying and the top 5 regrets there. I don't know if you know them offhand, but one I know for sure was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard, or I wish I spent more time with my kids. I think Well, they're the ones that stuck with me anyways.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Yeah, I know the number one and number two off the top of my head. And so that one's number two. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. And number one is also very related to this conversation, that I wish I had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. That's the number one regret.
Yeah, so powerful. And we're coming to the end of the podcast, but again, you came across this work devotion scheme or schema that I find fascinating. So you can tell our listeners about that. Now, this book is jam-packed with this. You talk about karoshi and death by work and all Japanese cultures and lots of different things. But this work devotion, can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so I really relate and love the work of sociologist Marie Blair Loy. She writes about the ideal work schema. And it's this belief that the ideal workers are those who prioritize work above everything else, and they're always available to their work. And that's what makes a good worker. And we kind of live with that prototype in our mind so that when we join the workforce, this is what we believe we need to do, right? In order to be the best worker, I need to prove to them that work is the most important thing to me. And there are hints of, you know, some change on a cultural level in terms of recognizing, and a lot of this came before COVID, but also I saw it like coming out of COVID, really a focus on, you know, it really made a lot of people realize, wow, how important family is, right? Just all the devastating, how COVID has devastated so many individuals and their families. And so I saw hints of change when people really reflected about what is important to them. But then I'm seeing some really disappointing signs too. You know, like, for example, organizations that are pulling back remote work and saying, nope, now we're mandating you got to be to work, you know, X number of days a week. And even though during COVID they talked about how important family was and how important balance was. And it's like, but you realize that we're just as productive. Data shows we are just as productive, if not more productive, working remotely, and people are much more satisfied. So it kind of ignoring that and saying, you know, oh, well, the most important thing is to be back at work. And so that makes me worry that maybe we're kind of losing that sense of focusing on our well-being and focusing on other things outside of work and going right back to this, oh, well, the ideal worker is that person who's there 5 days a week and showing that their FaceTime, you know, in the office. And so, yeah, it's really fascinating to see what's going on right now with especially the pullback of remote work.
What are the processes to disassemble a culture of work, or what can organizations do to combat overwork?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things. I think the first thing is really that self-reflection and looking at the organizational artifacts, all those things that we have been talking about that can signal to your employees what is valued. And so once you kind of do that assessment, you might know where some of the leverage points are. Maybe, for example, one of the issues is the cycle of responsiveness and the communication patterns with your team. So some actionable change can be made if you look for ways to break that cycle. And this can be done through conversations amongst the team with your leader. But the leader plays a big role here. The leader is the role model. The leader shows it sets the example for everyone else. And so a good way to kind of break that is for the leader to stop contacting employees outside of work hours. And some organizations ban this, right? And so, you know, you can set up technology too. This is another really great idea. Leverage technology to break this cycle. So I know some people that I've spoken with have talked about their company, and this is kind of few and far between that I hear this, that maybe they set it so if someone tries to send an email after work hours, a pop-up will occur and it'll say, are you sure you want to send this? You realize it's 9 p.m. Do you want to schedule that for tomorrow morning at 9? And almost like forcing people to think about that, because maybe it was just something of habit, not really thinking through the implications of how people would react to that. And so there are real changes that can be made, and it seems small, but cumulatively, it can make a big impact.
And in Ireland, we have legislation change in the last couple of years. We have the right to disconnect, which is wonderful that we can be seen as progressive in that way, at least.
Oh, I know. Look up to everything you're doing there, too. It's something that I would hope that one day we can do in the U.S. I aspire to that, at least. I think it would really go a long way. But right now, we kind of rely on companies, individual companies, to kind of make those changes. And then it's difficult to make change in a big, impactful way. So kudos to you all for doing that.
We're coming to the end of the podcast, and this is what we're trying to achieve on the podcast, is make some sort of impacts in a meaningful way. And this book definitely demonstrates that. If people were to find more about your book, Melissa, and more about what you do specifically, how might they do so?
Yeah, absolutely. People can connect with me on LinkedIn. They can also go to my website, which is melissaclark.com. It's just spelled a little different. So MalissaClark. Go ahead and connect with me either of those two ways. And I would love to have more conversations about this with people.
Melissa, thank you so much for joining the Workplace Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Workplace Podcast with your host, William Corliss. Our special thanks to this episode's guest for sharing their expertise with us. If you found this episode valuable, please rate and review it. For updates on future episodes and to get in contact with us about any workplace topics, please follow Yellowwood on LinkedIn and Twitter at Different Paths. As always, you can head over to yellowwood.ie for any other information. Yellowwood, your external learning and development partner. Provider of executive coaching, facilitation, and training. Take a different path to success with your career, leadership, team, and organization.